I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
If there's a global network of people who are guilty of crimes and are using their political systems to protect themselves and their people, like that's a global movement, and Project 2025 is all about that. And the global movement, by the way, Project 2025 is not that unusual, right? Like globally, it is all very much like this. It is physical force. It is raw power. It is deeply theocratic. It is very anti-woman. It's blood and soil nationalism in every case. So yeah, it is an assault on, you know, a constitutional system of, you know, peaceful transfers of power, which is the root of everything.
Hey folks, welcome back to Freedom Over Fascism. Over the last year, we've talked a lot about independent media and how important that is. And once more, revelations from last week prove even more strongly that our democracy can only thrive with media who are reporting in good faith on the stakes of every story. In just one example, we learned that the New York Times has been reporting so often on Biden's age because the publisher is peeved that Biden didn't give the New York Times an exclusive interview. That's how much personalities and grudges can shape coverage, which shapes elections, which shapes democracy. We've spent enough time talking together about how we can't count on the corporate media to educate America on the dangers of Trump winning. Simon Rosenberg, who was on the show last year, reminded me in his conversation with Tim Miller on The Bulwark that there are six things about Trump that we know now but didn't know in 2020 that voters are about to find out about Trump. These are the things we need to engage the public about right now. We can't wait for Jack Smith or the Supreme Court, for any trial court to find him guilty. We have enough material about him to talk to our friends and neighbors, and we can't make it contingent on him being found guilty. So here they are. One, he raped E. Jean Carroll in a department store dressing room. Second, he oversaw one of the largest financial frauds in all of American history. He's been fined $500 million for it, and he and his two sons have been banned from doing large amounts of business in the state of New York. Third, he stole America's secrets. He lied to the FBI about it, and he shared those secrets with other people. It is by far the greatest betrayal of America by a former president ever. Number four, he tried to overturn an election. He led an armed attack on the Capitol on one of the only days that every member of the U.S. Congress is present. He has promised to end American democracy for all time if he goes into the White House in 2025. Fifth, he and his family have corruptly taken more money from foreign governments than any political family in the history of the country. And sixth, he's singularly responsible for ending Roe, stripping the rights and freedoms away from more than half the population. That's us women. All of this leaves aside the fact that he flatulently falls asleep in court and can't control a single impulse that he has. These are the things we need to make sure people know as we move closer and closer to November. Today, we'll hear my conversation with Dimitri Melhorn, who, along with Reid Hoffman, who's one of the founders of LinkedIn, co-founded the investment fund called Invest in Us. This fund is investing heavily in media, advocacy organizations, electoral strategy groups, and other activity designed to make sure that Joe Biden wins the election in November and that Donald Trump loses. Also, as we've discussed over and over, the national election isn't the only important election. We know that state and local races are not only important, but they can energize voters and drive turnout that can produce reverse coattails for Democrats in state and national races. My conversation with Dimitri is fascinating for the way that his group views what is effective and when. He has strongly held views that we can agree or disagree on, but is certainly worth all the thought and time and money that is being invested. And then once again, our job is to amplify the message and get the vote out in our local areas. So here's my conversation with Dimitri. In the weeks to come, we'll hear from organizations recruiting and promoting young and diverse candidates in rural areas. We'll talk to organizers from various places around the country. We'll hear about more tools and initiatives to contest every race, and so much more. We hope to inspire you to use new tactics and tools to move the needle wherever you are. So, all of our content is freely available. But if you can afford to help, please subscribe at www.freedomoverfascism.us. We'll get right to my conversation with Dimitri after we hear about a new podcast called Build the Change.
Hey, I'm Alok, the host of Build the Change, a brand new podcast from MacBlue about the people at the center of progress. Join us on a journey across the country as we uncover stories about the everyday folks working together to build something bigger than themselves, real change. You'll hear from students in Appalachia advocating for LGBTQ-friendly books in their communities, healthcare workers providing telehealth abortions across the country, immigrant farm workers fighting for their safety in the blazing sun, and candidates in states with razor-thin margins. Listen to Build the Change now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Dimitri Melhorn, welcome to Freedom Over Fascism.
Thank you so much for having me. I prefer freedom to fascism, so I'm glad to be here.
I do too, and that's why I'm trying to make that happen. And here on this podcast, we talk a lot about the legacy media and how they're absolutely failing to let people know about the stakes of this election. And they've got this ridiculous idea that both sides are the same. And we've talked to a lot of people who have both called out that problem and started advancing solutions, like Tara McGowan and Corey, our newsroom, and others. So can you tell me about your efforts to fight fascism, preserve democracy and freedom from your perspective?
Sure. So the group that we founded, I founded it with a college schoolmate of mine who was a lot more financially successful than I was. So he's the money, and I guess he's the brains and the muscle too. So I don't know what that makes me, but he and I have been trying to invest in preventing Donald Trump from winning re-election in the United States. And so that is a specific variant of fascism versus freedom that we think is quite important. We think that Trump is a particularly American version of a longstanding human problem, and handing power to him a second time through a legitimate election would be an irreversible decision. So that's our primary thing. The subset of that that is most overlapping with your lane and interest and focus is how we understand what's true and what's not, right? Mm-hmm. So for us, part of that is investing in news platforms like Tara McGowan's. We have been supportive of her financially, but also other news platforms, like, for example, Jackie Payne at Galvanize. It's a network of white women where if you build a network where white women can meet each other and support each other and become a little bit more confident about their own opinions, turns out there's a downstream effect that makes them less likely to vote for fascists. So Galvanize and Good Information and Courier News, these are all ways of creating new kinds of news properties that reach more people. Another thing that's been a big investment for us, though, that might be interesting to you is we've invested a lot in litigation, because in our country, the way that people find out what's true is a lot of times they look to the courts. And that's one of the ways to address the problem of the traditional mainstream media's cultural biases that prevent them from covering this moment well. Because if you're a reporter at the New York Times and Donald Trump has just been found liable for fraud, you don't have to say, also, President Biden has been accused of some other fraud. Like, you don't have to say it. You can just say, hey, courts found him guilty. And so that is one of the things that we do.
That is really interesting. And I'm also interested in the grassroots element. One of the things I truly believe, especially in this environment, is people trust information from people they trust.
Yes.
Our listeners are primarily activists, so they are really important conduits to the general population if they'll talk to people in real life and not just in our echo chambers online.
By the way, it has to be outside your echo chambers, whether in real life or online.
Yes, right? Absolutely. Yeah, it has to be people you know, your neighbors, your hairstylist, whatever, not the people who you congregate with because you're soulmates. So this entire season has been really dedicated to tearing apart what the legacy media is doing and finding new and interesting ways to inform people who want to protect democracy. And I also agree that Trump is singular, and yet there's this Project 2025, which the right plans to implement no matter who wins as president, and has started implementing in MAGA captured, like red states already. So people who live in red states already know a lot of what's happening or what they plan to do. and we have to find a way to keep it from happening at the national level. Do you feel like your investments have borne fruit in the short term, or are you looking at longer term communications and power building?
The former. We believe that because of things like Project 2025, I mean, just taking a step back, a threat like Trump is singular, but the global threat of people like Trump is obvious to everybody. You know, we can say, oh gosh, shouldn't Joe Biden be beating Donald Trump by more? But, you know, Bibi Netanyahu seems to be guilty of a bunch of crime. Erdogan in Turkey seems to be guilty of a bunch of crime. If there's a global network of people who are guilty of crimes and are using their political systems to protect themselves and their people, like, that's a global movement, and Project 2025 is all about that. And the global movement, by the way, Project 2025 is not that unusual, right? Like, globally, it is all very much like this. It is physical force. It is raw power. It is deeply theocratic. It is very anti-woman. It's blood and soil nationalism in every case. It is an assault on, you know, a constitutional system of, you know, peaceful transfers of power, which is the root of everything. And unsurprising that that is being attacked, because it was explicitly attacked. And actually, he's running on pardoning the J6ers and implementing this kind of stuff with the Heritage Foundation, including Project 2025. So it is all coming together. And we believe that if he gets power, that Liz Cheney is right. That is it. That's it. He's going to die in office. The Constitution is not self-enforcing. Human beings have to enforce it. And at some point, somebody's going to have to say, no, sir, you can't run for a third term, and actually do something to stop him. And all the people who potentially do that, they can potentially do that between now and Election Day by stopping him from getting into office. Once he gets into office, you can't stop him anymore. So,
and specifically, he and Project 2025 have called out the 22nd Amendment, the limitation to two terms, as something they want to abolish. So I don't think there's any doubt, as you say, that if he gets into office, no matter what happens, that's the ballgame for at least a generation.
It's the ballgame for the United States federal government. You know, yes. The United States federal government will switch sides from the leader of the free world to a flunky of the other world at the federal level.
Yes, at the federal level. But they will also make a lot of the things that they have done on the state level federal priorities. So,
for sure,
those of us sitting here in blue states will no longer be in the bubble we think we are. And I'm in Massachusetts, by the way. And so it really affects all of us. And I think sometimes people in blue states think, oh, well, I'll help out in a red state, but phew, I'm safe. I even said that several years ago. Well, I'm in Massachusetts, we're doing fine, so let me help out in Indiana, or let me focus on state and local races all over the country, or in particularly MAGA areas. So you're focused on between now and November.
Well, till January 20th, to be precise, because, you know, exactly. So, if we were talking a minute ago about the unique threat from Trump and what happens, we believe that the kind of threat that Trump represents is permanent because we are humans. Therefore, there is no permanent victory. So are people like, well, if we beat Trump, there'll just be some other problem. And I'm like, yep, that's the human condition. So that's not a problem to be solved. The problem to be solved is to make sure that this generation hands the machinery to the next generation. So if Joe Biden defeats Donald Trump this fall, I believe that the bench on both parties will be in a position to get us past this. I believe we're okay for this moment if we win this one. Not great, but, like, you know, the Nikki Haley's and Josh Shapiro's and Gretchen Whitmer's and Wes Moore's of the world, I think, can get us back on track if the Trump movement is denied power. Because here's the other thing. Trump's getting older. If he's not president, he will be convicted. He will be a felon. And movements that are led by convicted felons tend to collapse. I don't know if you read the book that was very popular last year, Fever in the Heartland, about D.C. Stevenson and the Klan in the 30s. But yet, convictions burst movements and then they go away. So I think if we make it through this time, we'll be okay at the federal level. It doesn't mean we don't have a million things to fight for, but we won't have this fundamental question of whether we will be operating in a constitutional system or a violence-based system.
That makes sense. I want to go back to something you just said a minute ago about the bench. I believe that the Democratic bench is stronger maybe than it's ever been. I talk to candidates and officials and activists. It's really a deep and strong and young bench. You said that you thought there was a good bench on the other side.
So the bench on the other side is, it's a little hard to know what the other side is, to be clear. But, you know, in general, you could imagine a 2x2 grid. Actually, Tim Urban's book, What's Our Problem, uses this 2x2 grid. And there's left, right, and then there's idea-based and violence-based. So violence-based leftism is really not much of a threat right now. Maybe a little bit at the edges in 2020, maybe there was some, but mostly not. Like, the violence in this country is from the right, overwhelming and increasingly. And it's against cops, and it's against, it's mass shooting, it's so, and it's political, right? The Senate candidate, Katie Porter, you know, was excoriated on the left for using the term rigged in describing a financial advantage. Whereas on the right, they are openly talking about bloodbaths, right? So the thing that I'm looking for when I talk about the bench on the other side, I'm looking for the nonviolent right.
And is there such a thing anymore?
Yes, it's the never Trumpers or the maybe Trumpers or the never again Trumpers. It's the 30% of the people who voted for Nikki Haley. It's the, you know, it's the business leader. You know, there is an enormous appetite in this country for, you know, the traditional debates, like, should the state do more or less? What's the role of markets versus government? Like, this is an important thing to have a debate about, because either side, left to its own devices, will go too far. So the notion of human beings who believe in that kind of thing and are currently disfavored in the Republican Party, it's actually quite a long list. And the reason why the Tom Cottons and Ted Cruz's are on the rise, where the Mike Gallagher's are retiring, is because of the current state of the party. If there's one or two cycles where the Trumpists lose power, then it's all very fluid. The Democratic Party is different than it was even just a couple cycles ago. With, you know, with Trump's election, a lot of new people who are very centrist joined the party. People like Mikey Sherrill and Abby Spanberger, who are, you know, potentially future governors of New Jersey and Virginia. It's not guaranteed that in an alternate timeline, if they'd entered politics, they would have entered as Democrats, but they did. The party's changing. And so the Republican Party can change too. There's rising people like Brad Raffensperger, Stephen Ricker, Brian Kemp, Lisa Murkowski, Liz Cheney, who they drew a line at January 6th. You know, John Kelly, the former Trump official, to some extent, Mark Esper. You know, these are people who are saying now, never Trump, and maybe even Biden. I would strongly prefer a, you know, Wes Moore or Josh Shapiro or Gretchen Whitmer to a Liz Cheney as president or whatever, but they're fine. They're fine.
Right. They're not going to blow up the country.
Right.
And so when you look at funding, you know, who you fund, is it primarily progressive organizations, or does it run the gamut between progressive and sane Republican or former Republican or
So
not claiming to be Republican anymore, but would have been in a different world?
So sane Republican is a thing that doesn't really exist so much anymore. So we have moved some money to actual Republicans recently, but it's few and far between. So we supported Nikki Haley. We supported a big super PAC effort that was broadly supportive of Chris Christie. We have supported Brad Raffensperger and Stephen Ricker, the Maricopa County recorder, and Rusty Bowers. This is a small part of our portfolio because it doesn't perform very well. There's a few of them, but mostly not. In terms of organizations, so when we first started in 2017, our belief was that the important thing was to win elections. And so the first thing we did is we invested in the Virginia House of Delegates races. And then we invested in the, great place to learn. And then we invested in the closest battleground races in 2018. And we invested in a lot of different things. And what we found is that if you can choose between a dynamic, charismatic politician, like if you want a candidate, dynamism, charisma, authenticity, that's the most important thing. But if you can choose between a version of that that's progressive and a version of that that's centrist, the electoral performance is better if you get a centrist. You get more turnout on the left, you get less turnout on the right, and you get more swing voters in the middle. Now, again, the most important thing is charisma. So if you have an opportunity to get a high charisma leftist, take it, because they're good. But in general, we have found the center is a deeper place to win. One example of this, by the way, just in terms of progressive versus not, you can be strong and aggressive and forceful and still like where you draw the line of fight. So you could be really angry at the Dobbs decision, And you can be angry at the Dobbs decision from the perspective of what used to be called the pro-choice left. And you can also be angry at the Dobbs decision from the perspective of what used to be called pro-life republicanism, like the George Voinovich, Mitt Romney. Like, that is not like the woman being forced to flee the state of Texas to retain her reproductive capabilities. It's a different thing, right? So you can go strong on this stuff. And for example, on mainstream media, the thing with mainstream media, just getting back to progressive versus not, there's a really important choice that is going to be made by millions of young people in cities, millennials and Gen Z, about whether to vote or not. And the mainstream media will make it more likely to vote if they put a lot of effort into covering what is happening in red state MAGA America in terms of reproductive health, environment, guns, everything. If the mainstream media spends a lot of time elevating the personal complicity of the centrist American Democrats for the things that are going wrong by both Hamas and Bibi, if that's what the mainstream media is spending their time focused on, it is less likely that those people will feel it's cool to mobilize the turnout. So these are the kinds of things that it's about salience. How much are you focused? Like the both sidesism, and that occurs in progressive as well, right?
And progressive with the whole last 6 months, progressive has in some ways changed shape or revealed itself as more heterogeneous than we thought. One of my conversations recently was with Stephanie Shriok.
I love Stephanie. And we have moved money through a couple of things he's recommended.
She is fantastic. And I loved my conversation with her. It was great. And she, as I will remind our listeners, talked about the need to control more media, to own media stations, to build more pro-democracy media. I mean, you just hinted that something you agree with, but can you go any further on what you think of those kinds of ideas?
Very bullish. I think it might be of use to your audience to take one step further in thinking about strategies. So one of the debates that sometimes happens on the left is people will say a thing like, we need our philanthropists to shape the conversation. We need our side's versions of Rupert Murdoch and Elon Musk. You'll sometimes hear that. And for me, that reveals an important intellectual mistake. Because Elon Musk and Rupert Murdoch, from my perspective, are the opposite of each other. Because Elon Musk is a person who has gotten very rich with a bunch of different things. Government contracts, Starlink, Tesla, blah, 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 blah. And he used this money generated elsewhere to spend on media. And his acquisition of Twitter cost him something like $50 to $150 billion. And his political objective that he announced at the time he acquired it was for Republicans to win the 2022 midterms. So if the bad guys are spending $50 to $150 billion on media that does not actually achieve what they want, that's great. We like that. We don't want to replicate that. That's different from what Rupert has done. What Rupert has done is used his understanding of what people want to consume to deliver it to them. And from that accrue money and power. So we need to do that. We need to reach people where they are with communities and content that matters to them and engage them in a way that can produce financial and political sustainability. That's the Rupert model. That's what Tara is trying to do in a different way. That's what other groups are trying to do in a different way. That is not the Elon model, which is just buy a bunch of stuff.
The content is the key. So
actually, I think, the content is the key. But just to be clear on that, Stephanie, it's the audience needs are these, right? So
okay, yes.
Elon and Rupert were both pushing the same kind of content. Rupert was pushing from the perspective of, hey, audience, what version of this do you want? And let me meet it every friggin' day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a set of broadcasters that are made up to look like your fantasy. That's what Fox News is, right? What Elon is the reverse. It's here's the things I believe. I'm going to use my money to make you all listen to them. Right? Those are the opposite of each other.
Awesome.
And there are instincts on the left that like, we just have to buy the things and start pumping out the broccoli so that people eat their broccoli. And that answer is a bad answer because that means is you're going to buy these assets and you are going to drive all of their audiences to bad people because people don't want the broccoli. They want sugar.
So how do we provide the sugar in a way that people will hear it? Okay, let's call democracy sugar because that's the side we're on. And we all like ice cream. But if we don't own any of the means of delivery, we have a far lesser chance of delivering what the people want or even shaping what they think they want.
So let me ask you just, Stephanie, and by the way, Tara McGowan wrestles with this and does it the right way, but like, when do you need people to be thinking about the broccoli out of a 24-month period of time?
In October. Yeah,
maybe
October.
September. So you're talking about, let's be generous, let's say Labor Day through immediately after the election. So 2.5 months out of 24 that you need people to be thinking about the broccoli. So for one thing, don't try to give them any broccoli outside that window. Don't. Just build the trust, build the relationship, find out what they like, find out what they care about, learn more. No broccoli until the end. Now, you already have a ratio where the most broccoli you can get is 2.5/24. And even then, well, what kind of broccoli? I have learned from the 21 months of interacting with you that you're more of a savory broccoli with some bacon bits. And you, bizarrely, like your broccoli pureed in a shape, whatever. Like, you got to know that. But like, so with Tara's audience of low information voters, we have a sense of what will reach them. With Jackie Payne's audience of white women, we have some sense, but we don't know exactly. And by the way, like, you don't even, let's say I have a message that I think I want to deliver to this audience. It is currently April. I have to deliver this message because it's so important. It is almost certain that even if I were to successfully deliver that message, and the assumption here is that this is a broccoli message, so it's not easy to deliver, it costs me money, it costs me distribution, maybe even costs me some subscribers. I deliver this message, and I'm sure it's the right message because I've done the polls. The polls are asking people how they react to a message now, in April of 2024. That is not how they're going to react in October. So even if I were to move the broccoli now, it would be the wrong broccoli. So no broccoli until after Labor Day. And then the post-Labor Day broccoli is the broccoli that you want the most, user. If you're a Black person, it's broccoli about social pressure. If you're a young person, it's broccoli about getting out to vote down ballot to protect your reproductive rights. You know, whatever. The broccoli will vary. But the important thing is no broccoli yet. No broccoli.
But building trust. Right.
Trust. The thing about Fox News, there are many things about Fox News. One of the things about Fox News is that it's in everybody's ear all the time on their side. So, you know, this book that just made the rounds, Rural White Rage, that there's a controversy around. So one of the things that was reported in that book was about the debate between Oklahoma Governor Stitt and his Democratic challenger. And, you know, one of the major issues that Democrats point out about MAGA governance, like, obviously, number one is the way they treat women and reproductive health. But item two is probably the way they treat guns. Pretty bad. And so the Democrat said in her one and only debate in public against the incumbent Republican governor of Oklahoma, hey, guys, when she has to reach you, just want to flag, you know that per capita violence is higher in Oklahoma than in New York, right? Like, that's a problem, right? And the incumbent governor responds with a big smile and a slow Southern drawl and says, did I hear that right? Did she just say that? You all know that that's false. And that was that. Mm-hmm. So it's just familiarity. If I am going to a site every week, every day, multiple times a day, for the latest news about culture or whatever the thing is, I am going to presumptively assume they're telling me the truth when they mention a thing later. I'm at least going
to
listen.
The other thing that I've talked a lot to people is that the voter needs to be the hero of the story, which is one version of your don't feed them broccoli before October, before September, right? It's like, what do they want? What is interesting to them? What will get them to keep following you and paying attention? Aside from the activists, which you want to activate because they love broccoli.
Right? Yes. Yes. They do love their broccoli.
Right. So as you look forward, what do you see as kind of your roadmap for how you're going to, you know, being April right now, how you're going to invest between now and September, October, January?
Well, the first thing is there are some end of April deadlines for money to come in ways that literally are not available later. And so our top priority is to make sure that key infrastructure pieces like Tara McGowan Ibers, like Ben Wickler's employees in Wisconsin, et cetera, that they have the things that they need before those opportunities go. And by opportunities disappearing, I mean, like, those are votes we can't get later, no matter how much we spent, and we need a revote. Right. So that's the first priority. And I've mentioned that those are the sort of tent poles. Between sort of May through August is about helping the best existing models scale as much as possible. So reach as many people as possible. And then, and that there's two different kinds of that, right? So there's the platforms that reach swing voters, and there's the platform which reach Democratic non. With Democratic non-voters, the best thinking on the left is about how to engage Black voters, and we need more support from groups like Tamar Mokhtar at All Americans Vote and Julian Walker at Push Black. And, you know, some of those kinds of efforts are very important and powerful. For young voters, we have to do better in vertical video. So Tara McGowan is quite good at that. Her vertical video first reporting model has really got some legs under it. But we're going to need to do more innovation, and we're going to need to try to find platforms and entities and startups that are really good at raising the vertical video visibility of some of the real threats from Project 2025 and so forth. So those are some of the things we're looking at for over the summer.
And then does it shift again in after Labor Day?
Yeah, late money is very, very hard to spend well. We almost certainly will not be deploying standard late money like field broadcast operations. TV. Well, broadcast TV is important, but you move that money now, like literally. Because if you move the money now and reserve the rates now, it's just cheaper, a lot cheaper, like a lot cheaper. So it's way more cost effective. Reserve it now. And that's it. Just reserve it and figure out later what you're going to run, because that'll depend on what people care about then. Right.
Right.
So, yeah, we're helping support broadcast TV. We put resources into Future Forward USA, which is the super PAC that was originally kind of created by the Dustin Moskovitz team and is now run by Chauncey McLean and sort of favored by the Reelect. And it's broadcast TV bought now, and that's an important one. So spending the money late, like same dollars late, you know, half, a third as effective, maybe less even. So we're not going to do that. I don't know exactly what it will be. I will tell you that last time, by the time we got into September, almost all of our discretionary effort was focused on what we called the 78-day project, which was a portfolio that we set up in late 2019 because we started to hear some of the rumors that were later exposed in the January 6th committee hearings about what was happening. And so at that point, we were focused on just, you know, the bad guy had a lot of power physically, like he was in charge of the U.S. military and was trying to keep power, and it didn't quite work, but that was the goal. So there'll be some other thing that we'll be paying attention to, but at that point, it's much more like rapid response.
So you were hearing rumors or straight out statements that they were making. How deep is your network of informants? I mean, it sounds like a spy series, but like, how do you know what those rumors are?
So just broadly, we are not an intelligent network. We are a venture capital community, but we've made a lot of bets, including people who spend time trying to figure out what's going on in the dark web. And so you get something that looks and feels and smells like chatter as you're monitoring the other side. For example, when Lafayette Square happened and people from the Federal Bureau of Prisons in other states showed up in Washington, D.C. to control the crowds without their name tags on, that was an experiment, and people talked about ways that might be used. When there was unrest in Portland and people were pulled off the street, again, in cars by people without name tags, again, that was a test, right? And people were talking about those tests. People were talking about, for example, I'll give you a specific thing that we heard that we passed along to law enforcement. It never ended up happening. My belief and understanding is that law enforcement actually took it out. Maybe it was never a threat. But there were people who were saying, oh, Pennsylvania doesn't allow you to count. The Republican legislature is going to prevent that from being changed. It does not allow you to count ballots early. You can't begin counting until the day of the election. So anybody who votes early, their ballots will be piled up at the end, and there's going to be a lot of them, especially in the cities. And so those are the votes that are going to put Biden over the top, clearly, right? Philadelphia generated 750,000 net Democratic votes. You take it out, and Pennsylvania's a red state, right? So, you know, Pennsylvania without Philadelphia is Ohio. And so what if they've got these big piles of ballots, it's not done counting, they go home for the night, and there's a physical threat, like a firebombing? Then the federal authorities come in to keep it safe, but the chain of custody is broken. You have to throw them all out. It's not a partisan thing. You're just throwing those out. So those are the kinds of things that we were hearing about.
So the way that you are monitoring that, I think, is distinct from most people who have, aside from law enforcement, that have the ability to affect the outcome. You know, we can all talk about what we hear, but it has to be, you know, someone with the ability to make whatever changes are necessary, that's important. So that seems to me to be a really good choice on your part.
Well, it's not just
dialed in.
Well, it's not just law enforcement, right? So civil society, like, you know, during this project, I won't give names to protect the innocent, but a lot of people were involved. And, you know, they were interviewing people from overseas who had done resistance in quasi-autocratic states. They were, you know, for example, if you were to have that thing where there was a physical security threat to a ballot counting location in Pennsylvania and the law enforcement had not stopped it from happening, at that point, it's really important that you have a bunch of women-led groups from across the political spectrum linking arms outside to prevent the ballot counting from being disrupted, and linking arms literally, like arms linked, so that you're sitting down or lying down, not marching. And so the lawyers are briefed and the journalists are briefed and all the things, you know? So another thing that we did, we pushed out just in that particular case, you might like this in terms of mainstream media and coverage. So we were one of several groups that realized that the mail-in ballot was going to be overwhelmingly Democratic, which meant the day of ballot was going to be overwhelmingly Republican. And the rules were such that we saw this red wave, what the Bloomberg Hawkfish people later called the red mirage. We were like, oh, this is coming. And we saw some polling that overwhelming majorities, like 2 out of 3 people, were expecting to know the results of the election on election day. So we produced a video with some of our network, including a lot of talent from television and from stage. And it was a 3.5-minute long cartoon video called We Count! ! A 2D musical extravaganza. And it got millions of downloads as part of a broad national campaign to let people know this election was going to take a while to count. I suggest you look up that video and watch it, because it'll make you feel better, I think. It made me feel better.
There are positive versions happening all over the place. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing, is it's not just about the media. It's about, you know, people on the ground talking to people that they know. And the people on the ground are often replicating somebody, you know, some other group across the country, and they have no idea because there isn't a really good communication system among the activists. So trying to just at least make people familiar what else is happening is part of what I'm trying to do. What I'm fascinated by is how often you said women led. From my experience, most of the activists and the executive directors and the founders of new ventures, or even, you know, kind of legacy ventures, are women. But what is it that made you decide that women led was so important?
There are many answers to that question in general, but in the specific case of the 78-day project, protests and marches are highly volatile and very dangerous. It is very easy for the bad guys to use them for their own purposes.
Right.
And so if you have a bunch of people who are actively trying to protect vote counting, and a bunch of other people who have been whipped up into believing that the vote counting is fraudulent, very easy for there to be an altercation of some sort that justifies a crackdown and the ball game's over. The single tactic that was most effective internationally in preventing that was making sure that it was woman-led. Actually, young moms are the best. Older moms are pretty good too. Moms are good. But if you can't get moms, women's good. You're like, men in that situation make it more volatile. So the more that the leadership is from women, the better, both in terms of how they react and how others react to them.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want listeners who are primarily activists and candidates to know?
Yeah. So a couple things. One is this struggle. The term progressive is not entirely clear, but there is a a broad fight between rural theocracy and rule of law-based cosmopolitanism. And it's a global fight. And people in cities just have to turn out. So you have to get people to turn out. And most of the people we need to turn out and vote Democrat are not super left. If you look at the Gen Z and millennials in the cities who are going to be non-voters, there's a lot of them. There's like 5 million Gen Z and millennial voters in cities in the 7 closest swing states, and only less than half of them are on track to vote. So that means 2.5 million millennials and Gen Z in cities are just not going to vote. And if you dive deep into them, they're not going to vote. Like, some of them are progressive, and some of them may self-report that more progressive politics would get them to vote, but they're not being honest with themselves. That's not true. It doesn't happen. But mostly what is true and consistent about these younger non-voters in cities is that they're alienated from politics. They are immune to politics. They don't want to talk about politics. There's nobody who is 20 years old thinking, I wonder whether I should go out and vote. Can someone please tell me their point of view about this Donald Trump fellow? Not happening. So for that community, you have to find ways to engage them where they are. And so I just encourage people to just go on vertical video and see what's trending.
That can be done. And I think that we have a kind of a more volatile Gen Z than we have had in the last 4 years because of what's going on in the Middle East. Maybe they were non-voters before, but, you know, in 2018, a lot of them came out. And once you register them, they vote. Mm-hmm. A lot of them vote. But I think it's more volatile in terms of how they'll vote this time around. And there are a lot of reasons for that.
It's possible. We don't know. But the range of young voting behavior is not that wide. So the highest turnout among Gen Z in urban areas was that we know of in history is 2020. And the lowest that we know of is 2016. And for urban Gen Z, that range was about 35 to 45%. So 45% in 2020. And so 55% of people to 65% of people in this age category are historically non-voters every cycle. And so that's just a huge number. And I do think we're probably going to lose more marginal votes to third parties in this cohort than we have in the past. But that's like the difference between 10% and 20%. And I'm talking about like 55%, you know?
Right.
So I do think that non-voting is still the bigger mathematical thing right now to think about rather than persuasion of this crowd.
Well, I think it's a big problem in red states because people are just turned off from politics. They don't think they can change anything. And so the Republicans keep turning out and the Democrats or lean Democrat or whatever just don't because they don't think they can fix anything. That's, you know, internalized voter suppression.
Well, Stephanie, I don't know. This is the first area where I think you and I maybe actually disagree.
Okay.
I am trying to find out what causes people to vote at scale more often. And there is a theory on the left, the sort of progressive left, that people vote at scale more often if they think their vote will have an impact. I have seen no historical evidence of that either way. So the pro-life folks that voted decade after decade after decade in the face of failure were not voting to achieve an impact. They were rallying around that, but they did not believe that this election or the next one was going to succeed. Like decades later, they did. And the result of that was it suppressed their vote because they no longer were fired up, right? Delivering results, promising results, impact. Voting is a collective action. And so if you tell people, do a collective action, their instinct is, do people know? Is it being enforced? Right. And if the act of voting is seen as something that's expected in public, then you do it, just like you mow your lawn. And if it's not, you don't. And whether or not you're going to have an impact or not, like, honestly, to my knowledge, there are no elections at the federal level that have been decided by a single vote ever. And to my estimation, that will not happen ever because it's too unlikely. So there is no world in which a single vote will actually change even the election, let alone the post-election outcomes. So it is not the case that any vote ever is going to make a difference. It is that a vote is a way of expressing who you are.
And so that's a thing that I think if you're saying to someone, vote to express your voice, vote, this is your chance to say what you think about reproductive health, that's a good message. If your message is vote because you're going to make a difference, it'll never work in red states or blue.
I agree with that, absolutely.
Okay.
But that opposite can also be true, which is if people are told enough that they have no power and they will never make a difference, then they're much more likely to say, well, why bother?
Yeah. And that's a thing that as you're thinking about Gen Z turnout, we just don't know what's going to go on with this generation. But there is a chance that there's been some learned helplessness from COVID and everything. And that therefore, the energies that might drive a surge of community may be dissipated. We don't know yet. That's one of the things we've got to figure out and try to fix between now and Labor Day.
Well, that is quite an order. So I can't wait to see how you guys do. And I want to thank you for coming on because your perspective and your really grounded sense of what's going on based on the real world and not wishful thinking is really welcome. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah. And thanks for your voice. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. And thank you to our editor, Benji Wilson. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and please drop us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. We thank you for choosing freedom over fascism.